This is show two, The Conversation. Show two of our three-show bundle featuring D.S. Leiter and her project, Assertive Spirituality. We invite you to listen to the three-show bundle and then sign up for our talkback, where D.S. will be our guest and you can ask her your questions. That will be Wednesday, September 28th at 7 p.m. Eastern. Again, Wednesday, September 28th at 7 p.m. Eastern. A link to sign up is in the show notes, or go to our website, whatingods.com. That's all one word, whatingods.com, and click the magic button there. We're talking today with D.S. Leiter. Her project and blog is Assertive Spirituality, and I commend it to you, our listeners. Look it up at assertivespirituality.com. Like, it's not even a trick name. It's Assertive Spirituality, and that is the website. She's also active on Facebook. And D.S. is also a professor of communication in the University of Wisconsin system. D.S., I am so grateful that you can join us today.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
We love to start in our conversations with people to hear a little bit about where you've come from and where you are. It helps us and it helps our listeners just kind of get a sense of who we're talking with.
Absolutely. I grew up as a minister's kid in a right-leaning, moderate Christian denomination in the Midwest. If you'd asked me before December 23, 2021, about what it was like being a minister's kid and how it impacted me and this project, I would have given you a fairly rote, if interesting, answer about how I grew up. You know, everyone assumes that either you're going to be footloose or perfect kid and all of that. And I always talk about that when I teach positive and negative projections in my communication classes. You know, I'm like, I had both. No one allows you to be normal. And, you know, growing up in Christian Nice and how everyone thinks that accommodation is the only form of spirituality you're allowed, right? Spirituality is very passive, right? And that is all true, and it is still true, right? But what happened on December 23, 2021 is my retired minister father has been self-publishing these books for a while. There are a bunch of them, and I started reading them. And so I've been finding some really disturbing things in those, and I've been doing a lot of fact-finding, and I've been realizing on a lot of different levels how unhealthy some of those dynamics are that are represented, and sort of some of the roots of why I'm so driven to do this project and help people out being more assertive in the world of religio-political landscape. And of course, that became already aware to me in 2016 and before, right? Like, there's been so much in America that's changed and that's required more assertiveness. But yeah, like, that particular date was a watershed for me in personal understanding more of the personal things. And I'm still fact-finding and figuring stuff out around that. But yeah, it's definitely learning more. It's always good to know where you come from, right? And why are your passions come from.
You have a PhD in communication from Purdue, and you teach communication. And as I was preparing for this conversation, I realized that I wanted to ask you, what is the discipline of communication? What did you study, and what do you teach? And let me just add this. This is my little editorial comment. I was thinking, well, communication, if you teach communication, you must, I would think, have some conception of what a human being is about, what human nature is, like, just in terms of how communication is so quintessentially, well, I don't want to get too far down this path, but human conversation is a remarkable thing with so many dimensions to it. And so Tell us about communication.
Absolutely. Yes. I can go on about this for quite some time. I really love my discipline. And I should say, I also have 2 degrees in English. So I nothing against English. A lot of communication programs came out of English. And I have a background in book publishing between those things. Communication is such a great discipline because it's like, I know you guys work a lot with philosophy and theology, and those are wonderful disciplines, but I love communication because it can get super philosophical. And what does it mean to be human? And how can we literally be healthy as humans? Like, the first chapter of all my textbooks talk about how, you know, we literally get sick and die if we can't communicate in some way or another, right? There's all these effects on people in solitary confinement and all of that. Communicating is really important, whether by interpersonal or mediated means. And I love the variety of the field because you can get into all of that. It was sort of a way for me to get a PhD that was generalist while also being really specific at the same time. And I love that because you can apply it to just about anything. My major, as I created it, was media, narrative, and society. And the current thing that I do is I get a lot of students. I teach mostly interpersonal communication, which is more one-on-one, and small group communication, which is mostly 3 to 15 people. And I get all the students. We don't have a major at my school. So I get all the students who are trying to get out of public speaking or thought they signed up for a speech class that's public speaking, and then they end up in mine instead. But it's a really interesting challenge because I tend to get a lot of students with high communication apprehension. And that helped me really realize how these connections, and then having come into all of this, having studied all, you know, communication focuses on a lot of what does it mean to be a healthy communicator and what blocks us from that. And you know, the discipline came out of, I mean, rhetoric and the Greeks and all that, but also studying the world wars and, you know, what were the unhealthy propaganda things that led to things like the Holocaust and how can we prevent that happening again? And so looking at all those levels from students that are worried about, like, they have some sort of stress or trauma thing that's behind their social anxiety, and how can I teach them on a practical level to learn to be more assertive? Or, you know, I have students who maybe are overly aggressive from having an overdeveloped fight response, and how can I help them to make room for those students who may have, like, in some cases, PTSD in my classroom? And how can I meet those needs and help create a more balanced and mutual discussion space? And then outward to my discipline also looks at the fascistic rhetoric and, you know, how can we deal with that on a public level? And I get a chance to bring all of those tools to my project to help people be more assertive against the unhealthy things in religion and politics.
That's tremendous. And I have about 7 questions that I can't even remember. Like, as you talk, I'm like, I want to ask about that. And then you say something else. And I go, I want to ask about that. So here's one. You talked about part of your, I think, the undergraduate major that you designed having to do with narrative. You used the word narrative.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was my PhD, actually.
That was your PhD. Okay.
Yeah. We're allowed to choose our own concentrations.
Okay. And so my what I'm wondering is, does that have, do you know the narrative therapy modality in therapeutic practice? Narrative therapy, like, mm-hmm.
The stories we tell ourselves. I know a little bit about that, but it's not like the primary thing. I was more studying things about, though we do talk a lot about storytelling in narrative theory, right? And how it's sort of essential to us as humans. And it also, like, the stories we tell ourselves are often coming out of our stress responses. People who study narrative theory, it's about, like, trying to prevent bad things from happening. We tell stories to each other because we can't experience everything, right? And so looking at the ways in which it's often protective, mutually protective, but it can also, like all stress responses, be overblown, right? And so, yeah, we talk about that a little bit in my small group class.
Well, that's really fascinating. So just in terms of, again, the social stories we tell ourselves, the stories that are alive in our culture, if you think of the culture at large and the stories we tell ourselves, is there a parallel?
Absolutely is. I mean, when you think about Kenneth Burke was the theorist in rhetorical studies who was famously figured out before anyone else figured out Hitler was scapegoating the Jews. He'd figured it out from looking at his rhetoric like 4 years beforehand, right? And so using those kinds of tools, we can see how, you know, the kind of language that doesn't necessarily have to lead to genocide, right? But the kind that can lean us in that same direction. And that's the same way when we think about media, mediated narratives and mediated communication. They don't talk about like, oh, it forcing us to do things a certain way. They talk about affordances, right? Like you lean in a certain way. If you're writing a tweet, the limitations in terms of space, for instance, mean you're more likely to talk a certain way than others, right? And in the same way, like fascistic rhetoric doesn't have to force us in a particular direction.
It narrows and limits.
Right. And it can push us that way, which is sort of what persuasion is all about. It's never absolute, right? And that's where there's space for other people to push back against it.
That's very cool. All right. And then one other thing you said, I think very early on when you started talking about communication, was how your textbooks begin by observing that if we don't communicate, we die.
Mm-hmm.
Flip that on its head, if you would, for us. What is it about communication that, for human beings, that leads us towards life?
That's great. I love the, and of course, there's like a million things that come to mind as you're talking about that. But I think most specifically, I mean, I dip into, we're at the center of a lot of different fields, and I dip into psychology sometimes, and I dip into sociology sometimes, you know, like Brene Brown and shame is really helpful. And it's like stress, shame, and shadow from psychology are all sort of interlinked and sort of the same concept from different disciplines. And we look at how that looks at communication. But the ways in which communication can be life-giving, I really think about Emily Nagoski's book Burnout, and she talks about the, it's a sort of a feminist view on stress and how it impacts communication and how we can manage it. And there's a chapter in there where she sort of talks about connection as a form of co-regulation is how they talk about it in neurobiological studies. And this idea that like we can self-regulate our stress responses on our own, but we really need other people in order to do this. And I also think about like when we talk about communication and identity, there's this concept called reflected appraisal, where you think, but we tend to think of ourselves individually in our society, in American society, but in reality, all of our identities are either in reaction to someone else or together with someone else. And we literally need affirmation and, you know, to feel safe. And sort of thinking through the ways in which that connects to all of our visceral responses, right? Like if you feel unsafe in the world, it's literally going to mean that you're in stress mode all the time, which means that your body is like not doing well with your immune system because it cuts out all those inessential systems, right? So we need safe relationships in order to feel safe in the world. Otherwise, we're going to get a lot more trauma. We're going to get a lot more illness in major ways. And so we need to figure out, and loneliness can kill, but so can unhealthy relationships and unhealthy societies. And so figuring out all those links, I love the interdisciplinarity of my discipline because it allows me to draw on all these other disciplines. And I feel like that's a great picture of how the world should work, right? Like we should all be able to draw on each other's expertises and be able to figure out, like, hey, what is the way to thrive in the world? It's not about, like, theology is better than academia or philosophy is better than communication. It's like, look how cool it is. We can see these things from all these different perspectives, and yet there's so much overlap and understanding of how things really work. And I love communication because it feels like it's, to me, like it's at the center of all that.
It does. It does feel that way. The way you talk about it makes it sound that way. I have to agree.
Glad to hear. I'm persuasive.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I'm persuaded. You've got me. I can't leave this part of the conversation without asking about social media as part of our culture today. And I thought of that when you used the phrase, you were quoting an author. I think the phrase was mutual co-regulation. That's a positive thing. That's,
it is.
That's kind of the emotional emotional resonance one with another, I would imagine, or something like that. So the way I relate that to social media is I was thinking about social media as co-dysregulation. And part of it is the disembodied nature of social media. Like you lose a lot of emotional nuance in that mode of communication. Curious as to your thoughts about that. If not that, then even just general remarks about social media and communication and its effects on our society.
Absolutely. That's a really great question. And sort of thinking about that, like certainly my students who were online during pandemic would agree with you. A lot of them really hated it. And they were actually thankful because they're like, in your class, because we were still on Zoom and I already teach super interactively, they're like, we actually get to know our classmates. We didn't get to do this in other ways, you know, and we all get Zoom fatigue and all of that. And I know as a society, we've experienced a lot of disconnection because of pandemic and how we've had to adapt to it to try to keep people safe. And there's been no like perfect win-win solutions in any of that, right? But at the same time, when I think about that, I also think of like, I disagree with you a little bit on some of that, because a lot of it's how you use it. Again, it might lean you towards disconnection. It might lean towards more conflict. There's a possibility for that there. And yeah, like disinformation can spread so much faster and it's harder to fight it than it is for it to like, people don't listen as much to the corrections as they do to the original. So there's a lot of negative stuff out there, but also just thinking about, I have so many good, I have people I've met online in these online support groups that are well moderated, opportunities for people. I hang out with a lot of people in the ex-evangelical community that have really been harmed by especially politics since 2016 and things like that. Like there are a lot of situations in which you might not have people in your immediate area that can relate to you well, right? And you literally need the support. I'm thinking back right around the 2016 election. There was this group that formed really quickly called Pantsuit Nation. And it was this private group that grew to 4 million people in 17 days because there was so much bullying discourse out there. And it was a place where 4 million people had to go to feel safe and to have healthier discussions, right? And the influence of that has, you know, helped galvanize people, right? And I just think about, like, people do tend to poo-poo social media, but it's also a powerful place where people can connect if they don't have that co-regulation from people in the immediate future. And I've met people that I met online, and also people who have had traumatic experiences from bullying face-to-face often feel safer developing relationships there, right? Like, so again, like, viscerally, we don't always respond that it's less safe to be online if we find people that we can be safe around online. And sometimes that's not possible face-to-face, or sometimes, like, we need a supplement. And so social media has been great for making that possible, as well as, yeah, all the negative effects as well.
We're talking with D.S. Leiter. Her project and blog is Assertive Spirituality, which you can find at assertivespirituality.com. She's also active on Facebook, apropos of what we were just talking about. So you can find Assertive Spirituality on Facebook as well. I want to ask you about Assertive Spirituality, because that's how I found you. And it's, you know, as I read through your materials, I thought to myself, there is overlap here between what DS is doing and what the What in God's Name project is about. But I want to ask you about you and Assertive Spirituality. Talk about the word assertive. You do a nice job explaining this for those who go to DS's blog. It's right there at the top in terms of why you chose this name, but I would love to hear you talk about it. The assertive part and then the spirituality part.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So yeah, I had been thinking for a long time about all the weirdnesses, teaching all of this stuff in my classrooms about conflict and conflict styles and how weird it is, you know, like growing up, and I teach in the Midwest, right? And we have this culture of nice where like it's like living, if you're not from the Midwest, it's like living in a Jane Austen novel where like we find all of these passive aggressive ways to be mean to each other.
As a former Buckeye, I have to just chime in and say, well, I don't think no one's ever a former Buckeye. You're always a Buckeye if you're a Buckeye. But I just vouch for what you're saying in spades. So carry on.
And then you have this whole other level of Christian nice, right? And you have this whole level. And so like we have it double in the Midwest. And I understand there's a whole nother Southern nice thing that goes on too. We don't say bless your soul or bless your heart quite as sarcastically as they do in the South. But we have our own ways of dealing with this. And it's so interesting because, you know, like I talk about Midwest nice in my classrooms because I'm in a public university. And sometimes I reference Christian nice too. But like Midwest nice is this thing where sometimes we think from the outside, oh, that looks ideal, right? But a lot of times it's taking this avoider accommodator form of conflict management, which aren't ideal in a lot of situations. And looking further at the neurobiological research, like repressed emotion can literally lead to disease. And so if you're in a culture that teaches you to stuff your emotions, and that's the healthiest way, like that's a healthy form of stress response in some situations, right? Like avoidance and accommodation are healthy in some situations, but it can also be this unhealthy fawn response where you're trying to befriend the threat in order to, and so it can become this kind of culture where bullies get the loudest voices and no one else gets to be heard, right? And so it can lead to this weird form of authoritarianism, right? And so learning from having taught these conflict styles to students in all sorts of things, I started to think about my upbringing and Christian nice and just like, yeah, you start to understand all of these things, like what Elie Wiesel says about like silence in the face of the oppression is what causes problems. And you start to think about Letter from Birmingham Jail from MLK and all of these things where white nice is what perpetuates. It's not just bullies saying these things. It's also people refusing to step up against the bullies. And so the fact that I was thinking through all the different ways I could frame this project, and I was thinking about the concept of assertiveness, which one of my textbooks talks, all of my textbooks talk about it, but it's this idea of like there's aggression and there's passivity, and then there is assertiveness. And assertiveness is sort of showing respect for all parties and trying to meet everyone's needs as much as possible. And it's just so interesting to me when you think about the way that you know, love your neighbor as yourself is sort of all religions, you know, golden rule is in all religions. Communication research and interdisciplinary research shows us it's literally healthiest for us when we're able to achieve this kind of mutuality, right? And yet so much of the theology that you grow up with teaches you that, like, oh, it's Jesus, others, and then you, right? And we teach these hierarchies and that accommodation is the only way to deal with this. If you've been in a shame-based trauma thing, you need the opposite message. And just thinking about that Bible verse about the mountains are exalted and the hills made low, like, we need both sides of that. And assertive spirituality, like, spirituality is often a term that gets in a toxically masculine society, gets feminized, right? And told it's weak, right? And so the idea that you would put assertiveness next to that, apparently no one had ever bought that domain name when I looked at it. I'm like, okay, there's a need, right? And just the juxtaposition, the fact that we don't think of those two words together is something that is, I found really important and was like, okay, there's a need for this project, right? I couldn't go through the recent era without offering what I could do, what I'm already working on in the classroom, do whatever I can and out in the world to try to help people with this.
Yeah, that's so interesting. There are a couple of things I just wanted to respond with. The Christian nice, I hear that as the too passive kind of side of the extreme. And then there is, I'll just call it Christian authoritarian.
Oh, yeah.
Which is,
yeah.
Which you would, I think, in your taxonomy would characterize as aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
So assertive finds this space in the middle between those two extremes.
Right.
And then the other thing I thought about was Jesus. And certainly I grew up, I did not grow up as a Christian, and here I am as a Christian minister, just found my way there. But I always had this impression, maybe because I was a Buckeye, Jesus was always sweet and nice.
Uh-huh.
And the more that you know, if you actually read the stories, Jesus isn't always sweet and nice.
No, exactly.
And so there is, you know, if we are Christians and want to form ourselves after the pattern of Jesus, it would lead to, I would say, an assertive spirituality.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And like, it's so interesting to me how you have to downplay, you have to sort of cherry pick, right? We have all these weird ideas, like we can only love each other by not holding them accountable. Or, you know, like we can only love each other by kowtowing, right? And it's so interesting because Jesus gives us, you know, it's not just Jesus didn't open his mouth when he was at his crucifixion. And we tend to take that as more important than the other parts of the story. Whereas he's calling out oppression and he's calling out spiritual abuse and he's calling out all of these unhealthy patterns, and he's not doing it in a nice way. He's calling people names. And in the context where you have a powerful thing, he's looking out for the vulnerable in those situations, and he's doing it in assertive ways. He's not aggressive because he's on behalf of, you know, again, like on behalf of the people who are vulnerable, he's saying really strongly but assertively, this is wrong. And he's doing it publicly so that the people who are hurt can feel defended, right? And so that, you know, they can see that resistance against that powerful thing that's causing damage to people, literally. And as I've developed into my own assertive voice, I've had to like speak back to that socialization in me too, right? That it's not, and realizing how much of the spirituality I was raised in was around like sort of idolizing one part of one action of Jesus. And it's just like, there are lots of different models for this, and looking at the theme of the Bible overall and looking at the theme of a lot of different religions, it's about mutualism and it's about speaking back against oppression and like being on behalf of, you know, trying to find win-win solutions more than that and fighting back against zero-sum expectations for things.
In your own journey towards practicing assertive communication, assertively spiritual communication, did you do some training? Do you, like, these are things that people can learn.
I mean, yes and no. I mean, it's about figuring out, I've been teaching this stuff for a while. And so I've been practicing it as I've been teaching it. And, you know, I tell my students, I'm like, occasionally I have a student who repeats a class and I'm always like, there's no getting to the end of this material, right? Like, it's always, because it's so much about practice. It's like saying, oh, I played a scale on the piano once, so therefore I'm done with it. You know, like, you got to practice this stuff over and over again. And especially when it's really visceral things, you know, and there is help that you can get. But yeah, a lot of assertiveness, problems with that often come from trauma. So yeah, I've done trauma therapy to help with, because I had a strong fawn response. And like learning there's forms of trauma therapy that can help literally retrain your neurobiology and help you understand the roots of that. And that can be a really powerful tool. Like, talk therapy is really helpful, but like moving deeper into some of those visceral responses can be really helpful. And yeah, like, we have all sorts of methods in my classrooms, and that's helpful. But sometimes, especially if you've got like deep trauma stuff behind your lack of assertiveness, sometimes you need the help of a stress and trauma therapist. And I always tell my students that, like, you know, we go, when we have a muscle problem, we go to PT. Why is it we have all this stigma around going to stress and trauma specifically trained therapists? It's the same thing. It's just a different format of it. And it makes me sad that there's not mental health access for everyone, right? Like, it's easier to get to a physical therapist than it is to get to a trauma therapist. And there is, like, really no separation between mental and physical health. So it also makes me sort of sad that it's placed there, because there's so much overlap. And it feels like it stops us from addressing so many of our physical health concerns in our society, as well as the mental health ones.
We're talking with D.S. Leiter. Her project and blog is Assertive Spirituality, which we've just talked about. We've taken both of those words and explored them. D.S., I want to shift to this question, which arises from reading through your blog, and it's a question I ponder and we ponder in our project a lot, which has to do with the relationship of religion and politics, spirituality and politics. And on our show, we have a lot of things to say about that in terms of, we have a lot of things to say about that. But I'm curious what you have to say about that. And particularly, I feel like in our culture, everything is politicized to the point where even our churches, and I don't need you to comment on churches, this is just my observation, even our churches are politicized. Like, churches are divided the way the body politic is divided, which means to me there's a failure in the churches. Because we should be formed, if we're serious about our spirituality, that should form us first, and our political identity is of less importance or lower importance.
Mm-hmm.
Curious how you think about this as you write in your blog. What is the relationship for you between assertive spirituality and politics?
It's such a big question. It's certainly something that on my journey, and I know I blogged about this quite a few times, I had a really interesting view of this, because I came from what I thought of as a moderate, but I've realized is right-leaning moderate. I had a mentor once describe it as a church that's like on the borderline between mainline and evangelical, right? And being in one of those moderate denominations has really allowed me to see the ways in what you've described happens, right? You have families split over, and we're not the only denomination that has had families split over these politics of the last few years. Often the church has allowed these politics and these other unhealthy systems that we don't necessarily think of as political, but have been politicized, like toxic masculinity, like white supremacy, all of those things. And so what happens is you've had the country dragged politically right and also theologically right in terms of the loudest voices. And, you know, like my political stances I used to describe as moderate and independent, and all of a sudden I'm a flaming liberal because things get dragged. And it's because, and it feels very disorienting for a lot of people, especially if you grew up in a more privileged part of society where you didn't notice this stuff ahead of time. Sorry, marginalized people that we didn't notice, right? But if you grew up white like I did, you don't notice these things as well. We talk about in our perceptions chapter in my interpersonal class, we talk about standpoint theory. And I always describe, like, you know, I was a nerd in junior high and I noticed the power dynamics better than the people who were in the popular group, right? There's always going to be these blind spots that we have. And so we need to learn to listen to people from those marginalized populations, or we're just going to have more and more blind spots, right? And so, you know, my goal is not primarily political. And especially in my classrooms, I'm always like, we're not going to be partisan here. But in my small group class, I teach how to deal with civic action questions from a problem-solving orientation, right? And so I'm like, I don't necessarily think that even in churches, like, spirituality needs to come first necessarily. I think if you're really looking at loving your neighbor as yourself, it should be about, like, let's find the problems, let's figure out how to take care of the vulnerable people and try to bring things to more spaces of love your neighbor as yourself mutuality stuff, right? And it feels like sometimes the spiritual language can get in the way of that. And it can also allow for, you know, like, these other elements to creep in the name of spirituality, and that can lead to a lot of spiritual trauma on top of other trauma that people are already experiencing. And yeah, like, I'm sort of pleased that I get a chance to do that having grown up in the church and worked in Christian organizations. It's sort of nice to be able to do that from outside of that. And also, you know, I'm not teaching from a political standpoint. And I don't even think of myself as working from a political standpoint so much as I'm looking for the solutions that are going to act out love your neighbor as yourself, which is something that intersectionally across spirituality, politics, and religion, and, you know, just academia, like, all of these findings intersect in that way. So you don't necessarily have to be religious to practice assertive spirituality, right? And so thinking through that gives more freedom to make space for a plurality of perspectives on it.
I'd love to ask you this question of what motivates you to do this work. You're so passionate about it. It's been really a gift to hear you speak. And so what that is at the heart of what you do?
I mean, honestly, like, I could idealize and be like, oh, some high up sort of thing, but I find that a little unsafe. Because of some of the things I experienced. And honestly, like, I've realized one of the reasons that I teach what I teach, it's about helping the world feel safer for me, as well as others, right? And I've realized that, like, I can't feel safe if the people around me don't know this. I know, right? Because these are such useful tools and findings. That I feel safer being in relationship with people of all types of relationship and having people out there in the world who understand these things better, and how like our visceral responses often come up. And one of the problems with, you know, Western rationalism is that a lot of times we haven't allowed space for those visceral responses, and we don't even acknowledge them a lot of times, and yet they drive us. And this is actually one of the things I see as a problem in white supremacy, right? Like, we see tribalism as something that only happens over there, and unhealthy tribalisms. And it's like, fascism is the same thing, right? Like, we're not better than those other societies, right? We're still acting from visceral responses, and we're doing it in healthy ways, and we're doing it in unhealthy ways. But if we don't acknowledge those unhealthy ways, then we're not going to fix things. And I've had experiences with people who just like enforce avoidance of the difficult topics, right? And enforce, you have to do it this way, right? And that is, and it's often been hidden in these situations that look spiritual and look okay and look like politically correct or whatever. But it's using all that stuff as a weapon. And so having experienced some of that harm myself and having to work through that, and just like, you know, I didn't always know the roots of that, like I've said, right? And I'm still working to find out the roots of some of that. It's really cool looking back to see how, you know, so much of what we do, even things like, you know, being interested in this field, it can seem very elitist to get a PhD. It can feel very elitist to pursue education. But looking back, I can see how this has all been I want to help myself and others feel safe sort of thing. And, you know, the same thing, like there's so many, I think I saw a Neil Gaiman quote the other day about how books, like in the Holocaust, people having a book was illegal, right? But stories helped keep people safe. And it, like, it's really important that we as a society not like feminize these disciplines, because they are things that literally, because that is participating with this kind of othering, right? It fits in that same category of those liberal elites, right? Like academic liberal elites sort of thing. And just recognizing that, like, we learn critical thinking disciplines for good survival reasons. And it's so cool that I get to study stress, trauma, and conflict communication, because I can see all those different ways and getting to offer those tools to other people so that they can literally read the room and read themselves and others better, and really be able to understand, like, trauma is often about stuckness and feeling overwhelmed in a situation. That's really what it comes down to. We've got too much stress response. We're feeling too many threats, right? But it's about us not feeling like we have the tools to deal with it, right? And so I feel honored to be in a field where we have a lot of terms to place to things. And even if we can't overcome things, being able to name them really grounds me. And I'm really excited about getting to offer that to other people and tools to, like, you know, practical strategies. And you know, again, like, we get philosophical and we can get spiritual about it, but it never goes too far from the practical. It's what I love about communication, and it feels like that's a really helpful voice to add to the mix, right? It's not better than philosophy or theology, but I feel like it's a voice that doesn't speak up enough, which is ironic considering it's communication. So yeah, that's what drives me, a lot of what drives me, at least.
Do you have hope for the future? As someone who works with young people and as someone who is a keen observer of our society and the forces at work, do you have hope for us?
I mean, I do. But I have hope for us not necessarily because of what I see in my classroom at the beginning, for sure, right? Like, there's a lot of work that needs to be done. right? I see a lot of work that needs to be done. And I see a lot of dangers out there. Like, one of the things we tend to dismiss people with trauma responses as though everything they're doing is what we call hypervigilant, where you're overblowing things. And that's certainly accurate in some situations, right? But there's a lot of vigilance as well, like real threats out there and real things that need to be identified and overcome. And that's definitely huge in our society. And ignoring those things is not helping us in any way. Like, we all need to step away and take breaks and, like, look at, you know, I go kayaking so that I can absorb beauty and stalk wildlife. And, like, we need that alongside that so that we can keep the stress energy in a healthy place so that we can continue doing it. Right. But it's not, we have to keep doing what we can, because none of us can deal with this stuff on our own. And the hope that I find is that our neurobiologies can be retrained, right? And, like, feeling grounded in what I study and teach is what's helpful. Like, I know that often, you know, if bad things happen to us in the past, we're going to look sometimes only for danger, and we're going to get all cynical, and we're going to feel like there's no hope, right? But I know that, like, that's our neurobiology, and it's not always, I'm always saying in my classes, like, stress responses are often, they're trying to save us, but they do it sometimes in misguided ways, right? Just because bad things are happening doesn't mean good things can't happen if we take action collectively, right? And so there's a really important need when we feel that way to, like, hold each other up.
DS, I wanted to give you the opportunity, if there was anything that I didn't ask that you had wished I had asked, or any...
Just wanted to, like, thank you so much for having me on the podcast, and I really appreciate it. And I look forward to learning more about your project too. It seems like there's a lot of intersections. That'll be fun to look into that more. I haven't had as much time as I would like to. But yeah, just want to also, like, throw out, we're actually moving towards doing more resources on my project too. And in fact, now if you sign up for the email newsletter, you get a free guide to online trolls, which is helpful for offline conflict as well, sort of, like, talks more about the stress responses and how we react, and sort of helps you sort of think through that and, like, how can we respond when we feel threatened, right? No one can do everything all the time. No one can fix the world. But if we all work together to do what we can where we are with what we've got, and work on this relay marathon, you know, we can fix a lot collectively if we don't get in our own ways about that too much, and in each other's ways, if we don't take out our frustrations on each other. And I love feeling empowered by the tools I have, and I want to offer that to other people too. And I want to work with other people who have other tools so that we can get stronger together.
We're talking with D.S. Leiter. Her project and blog is Assertive Spirituality, which you can find at assertivespirituality.com. D.S., thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. It's been a true pleasure for me to get to know you and to learn about assertive spirituality and your project.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
We invite you to listen to the three-show bundle and then sign up for our talkback, where DS will be our guest and you can ask her your questions. That will be Wednesday, September 28th at 7 p.m. Eastern. Again, Wednesday, September 28th at 7 p.m. Eastern. A link to sign up is in the show notes, or go to our website, whatingods.com. That's all one word, whatingods.com. And click the magic button there.